You're listening to KDNK's Public Affairs program for Land's Sake. I'm your host, Bill Kite. Today, our guest is Callie Carswell, and Callie's the contributing editor for High Country News, and she's wrote a really good article here, this issue for August the 6th. She, as a contributing editor, she appears on the cover with her husband, and the title of the story is, What Are We Doing Here? And so with that, we're going to welcome Callie to the show. How are you doing, Callie?
Hi, Bill. I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for being on the show. You know, I'd really want to say a few words about High Country News. If you don't take that magazine, you really should. I talked to the publisher, Paul Larmer, and he said that article was really, it touched a chord with people, and a lot of people have commented on it. And, you know, that High Country News just has quality journalism in it, and your article is no exception. It's just, it's a great article. So let's cut right to the chase, Callie. And I'd like to quote, in my opinion, the most important paragraph that was in the story. And here it goes. The answers I sought, I began to understand, could not be found in climate studies, water plans, or market analysis, because my questions, my doubts, weren't ultimately about logic or pragmatism. They were about love. Can you tell us about the love you have for the land you moved to, and how that affects you, and what the real core of this story is about?
Sure. So by way of a little background, I was born in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and my parents are from here, but I grew up mostly in Chicago. And when I was a kid, probably for the first 10 years or so of my life, we lived in Chicago most of the year, but we would come to Santa Fe in the summers for about 2 months, and we would live in the house my dad grew up on, which is kind of in the foothills outside of Santa Fe on about 3 acres of land. And for reasons that I can't totally explain, from a very, very young age, even though I really lived in Chicago, I felt like New Mexico was where I was really from. And I have this memory of, I don't know if I actually said this to anyone or if it was just something I sort of rehearsed in my head, but I have this memory of, if somebody would ask me where I was from, I would tell them that I live in Chicago, but I'm from New Mexico. I don't know, you know, it was just like this sort of feeling that I kind of always had that this was a place where my family was rooted. It felt to me like New Mexico was kind of the stage upon which our family history had really played out. My grandparents are buried on this land right behind the back door of the house where my dad grew up. And I'm also an only child, and I felt, I'm not entirely sure if other only children have this experience, but as an only child, I think you perhaps contemplate your parents' mortality, maybe more than people with siblings do. And I always kind of thought that when my parents died, this house and this land is sort of what I would have left of my family, and it was really important to me for that reason too. And so, yeah, New Mexico and Santa Fe were just always these really special places for me, and kind of the places that I always wanted to get back to. One of the reasons I actually originally went to work for High Country News is I was just kind of like slowly trying to plot my way back to New Mexico. And I was interested in journalism and writing about the environment, and thought, High Country News just wrote really strongly about people in place, and that if I went and worked there, that I could work my way back to New Mexico and get here eventually.
It worked, I guess, didn't it?
Yeah, it worked out, luckily.
Well, and I need to have a disclaimer here. I'm a native New Mexican from the land of enchantment. And I think, you know, the next 20 minutes, that's what we're going to talk about, is how we feel attached to special places that aren't necessarily where we were born, but that we have an affinity to, and that really touch us at the most, really the deepest places where love comes from. You know, you credit the late New Mexico poet and historian Esteban Arellano with defining what we are talking about with a word, and I probably won't pronounce it right, querencia, which is a place from
querencia, yeah.
A place from which one's strength of character is drawn. Can you elucidate on that?
Yeah, so Esteban Arellano, I don't think he didn't actually come up with the term. It's sort of a folklore term in Spanish that's used in New Mexico, but he, I thought, had a really eloquent way of defining it. And so the word querencia comes from the Spanish verb querer, which means to love, to want, or desire. And the word essentially describes a love of place. So your querencia is a place where you feel like you belong, a place where you feel rooted, and a place that is central in some sense to your identity as a person. And it's a place, as Arellano has written, where you feel safe. So here in New Mexico, it's people use it to describe places they love, but it's also, for instance, used by ranchers to talk about their cattle. I interviewed one lifelong Northern New Mexican for this story who grew up on a subsistence ranch near Taos, and when he was young, he and his dad would, you know, go into the mountains to check on their cattle in the summer, and certain cattle, they would sort of always find them in certain areas of the mountains, and so they would refer to those areas where they would always find those certain cows as those cows, querencia.
You know, some of us have a broad sense of that place that's special to us, that sense of place. And to me, it's the Colorado Plateau, where the pinyon juniper is, whether it's in Quemado or Pinetown, New Mexico, or here in Carbondale, which I love very much as a town. And maybe I'll talk a little bit about that in connection with some of what you wrote. You know, in my long 38-year career with land management agencies, I've seen many natural landscapes that call to us, like what we're talking about here, that we love, totally transformed into man-made cultural landscapes that assault my sense of place beyond belief. And you introduce for the reader a powerful term, say it for me. I know I'm going to have trouble saying it.
Solastalgia.
Right.
It comes from the word nostalgia.
It's the pain experienced when there's a recognition that a place where one resides and that one loves is under immediate assault. How do we heal that pain from that assault? Because it can be from many things. In your article, it could be from drought. It could be from climate change, from people coming and changing the place. A lot of people move into a place and bring the things they're trying to get away from with them, and it assaults the place itself. So how do we heal that pain?
Well, I don't know that there's a simple answer to that question or an answer that's going to work for everyone, but, you know, in some way that's sort of what I was exploring in this story. So I moved back to Santa Fe in 2014 with my husband, and, you know, as I was kind of saying before, this is a move that I had sort of been plotting my whole life and waiting for my whole life. And so I was really excited, you know, it felt like coming home. But at the same time, at this point, I was working as a climate journalist, writing about climate change in the West all the time. Really soon before we moved, I had just written a big story for High Country News about forest die-off in the western U.S., driven by drought and high temperatures. A lot of that story was based right here in northern New Mexico in the Jemez Mountains, where we've seen both catastrophic fires and just trees dying because it's been really hot and dry. And so I was coming back, you know, sort of having this happy homecoming in this context where I was in my professional life kind of constantly writing about all these bad things that were going to happen in the Southwest. I had been living in Western Colorado, and so I was moving south to hotter and drier. And So, you know, I kind of had these, like, these little sort of nagging questions in the back of my mind, like, is this a really good idea? Shouldn't I be moving to Minnesota? Wouldn't that be the smart thing to do? Am I going to get my family into trouble moving us here? And this year, I think you guys experienced the same in Western Colorado. We just had an incredibly, incredibly dry winter. It was so dry that it sort of felt like it was never going to rain or snow again.
Right.
And for me, I think it was the first time where I just felt like I sort of really felt like I was seeing climate change and it was happening around me and I could feel it on this really visceral level. And I just started feeling a lot more anxious about it. And these questions, these sort of quieter questions that I had had coming back here of, you know, is this a place I should be starting a life? Got a lot louder. So that's what I was really exploring in this story. And going back to your question of, you know, how do we heal this pain? At first I thought, well, this is kind of a hard question to answer because I'm sort of experiencing it, but I'm sort of not, because I'm sort of worried about not just what's happening now, but sort of what's going to happen in the future, these things we haven't experienced yet. But then on the other hand, there are communities in northern New Mexico that have experienced the total transformation of their landscape already through really severe fires. So one of the things that I did in researching this story was go and talk to people from those communities and sort of see how their lives, their sense of home had been changed by the wildfires. And it was pretty interesting and kind of unexpectedly a little bit hopeful. So I went to both Los Alamos and talked to a woman, an ecologist there, who had kind of really helped her community grapple with the grief of their losses after the 2000 Cerro Grande fire. And then I also talked to people from Santa Clara Pueblo, they're located near Los Alamos. And that Pueblo has experienced 3 very large wildfires over the past 20 years, which have burned 80% of their forest and even cut off tribal access to their ancestral landscape. This is a place they've called home for more than 1,000 years in a physical sense, and in a spiritual sense, they believe it's their home since time immemorial. So
right.
For them, that's a really big deal. The woman I talked to in Los Alamos, she said that, you know, not everyone reacted to it the same. Some people did leave because they lived there because they loved the forest and they just couldn't stand to look at a mountainside full of blackened sticks. And she told me about one couple who left and they moved to, I think it was Pagosa Springs, you know, right back into the pine forest into maybe
right.
a future burn zone. But then a lot of people had a different reaction, and their reaction wasn't that they needed to flee, but that they needed to do something within their community to help.
Right.
And so one of the things that a couple of people did, just as an example of that, is they formed something called the Volunteer Task Force that went out and rebuilt trails. They organized things like, they had school kids and people in nursing homes make seed balls, which are like mashups of wildflower seeds and clay. And the people doing trail work would go out into the forest and just throw them out there so that, you know, when it rained again, the clay would melt and the seeds would be planted.
Right.
Things like that, just getting back out onto the landscape and doing something,
right.
having a sense of ownership.
There are things that we can all do.
Over the change.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and just and sort of little stuff, you know, just engaging in small ways, both with the landscape and with your neighbors and the people in your community, she said was really crucial in helping people heal and move on. And people from Santa Clara, you know, said something similar, but from a different perspective. They like I was saying, you know, this is their ancestral home. It's been their home since time immemorial. And people who are still living there, they don't really see it as an option to just leave when right. things change. This is their home. There isn't another one
right.
In their view. And so...
Yeah, that's a lot of us feel that way, don't we? That this is our home.
Yeah,
and I think
a lot of us do.
Your husband kind of said that when you talked about, you know, so if we do lose everything, we run out of water, it's going to be part of our story. You're
right,
listening
yeah.
to Katie and Kay's Public Affairs program for Land's Sake. I'm Bill Kite, your host, and today our guest is Callie Carswell, contributing editor for High Country News. Your attachment to place, like a lot of our own attachments to place. You said you feel that it was always instinctual. And I think mm-hmm. as humans that we all are looking for that special place to call home, that really we feel at home there. And when we're gone, we want to come back to it. And yet, you know, is a special places are in danger of being overrun. Carbondale, because everyone wants to move here because it's the place to be. And pretty soon then, you know, your sense of place is assaulted, like I mentioned earlier, and how do we keep that sense of place intact?
Well, again, there, you know, I think it's a really tough question, and there's no simple answer, and there's no, you know, one right answer that's going to be right for all people and all places. But I did come away with this, I think, thinking of some general things, and this sort of goes back to, I think in some way the answer is similar to the answer to the last question, which, you know, one thing that we need to do is to be engaged with these places and stay engaged, spend more time on the land, talk to your neighbors, patronize your local businesses, go to city council meetings, understand how your community is bracing itself for change. How is it dealing with it or preparing it? How is it managing its critical resources like its water and its forests? Is it, you know, there are things that we can do to deal with these changes and sort of ease these transitions that in some ways might be inevitable and protect the things that are important to our communities and the sense of place that we find so important there. And so within that, it's also important to, I think, identify what those important things are. You know, what is it that matters to you as a community? What are those features of your place that are special to it that might be in jeopardy for some reason?
Right.
You know, why are they in jeopardy? And you sort of need to answer those questions before you can figure out what to do.
Yeah.
And, you know, I talked to a farmer here in northern New Mexico who comes from a Spanish family. He's farming the same land that his ancestors started farming 400 years ago. So he has a very strong sense of place both in northern New Mexico and on that specific piece of land. And he's really active in what here is called the Acequia Association. So acequias in northern New Mexico they're essentially agricultural ditches, but there's this particular form of governance that revolves around the acequia. And, you know, he was talking about how he doesn't think that all agricultural communities in the Southwest and certainly in northern New Mexico are going to survive as water becomes more scarce and the climate changes. And one of the reasons for that is that there are much more profitable ways to use that water. You can make more money transferring the water to cities or suburban developments and building houses with it. And in some cases, we're going to decide to do that. But, you know, his sort of perspective was it's important to recognize that we lose something when we do that too. And, you know, if agriculture and if his community in northern New Mexico is going to survive, it's probably not going to be because there's a great economic argument for it. But it's going to be because as a state and as a community, we've decided, you know, that these, that having local agriculture and preserving the history and culture of these communities is important for other reasons. You know, it's important to who we are,
right?
And to our resilience in other ways.
Right.
So, we're
going to have that tested here in Glenwood Springs by economic development, whether it will take the lead or not in expansion of a limestone quarry that just is not appropriate to the level they want to expand it. And the community is going to be coming together to try to deal with that. And sometimes the economic advantage shouldn't be what drives our decisions, although it seems like in this world we live in now that that seems to be what does drive a lot of people. So it's always a question of what do we put first in our lives, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Anything else that you would like to say here about your article? If I find it very interesting, I read it twice, and my girlfriend Kate read it over and got really excited about it. Anything you'd like to add about that article in the next 3 minutes we have?
Sure. So just briefly to end, I think that, you know, one of the things here, I often am writing and talking about climate change in this very sort of intellectual, technical way, and what I was doing here was really writing about the personal and emotional dimensions of it, and that there is, and recognizing, I think, just that there is personal and emotional pain associated with environmental change we experience. And I think that in order to deal with that, one of the things we need to do more often is just really basic, and it's just to acknowledge that that pain exists, and talk about it. As we figure out, you know, not only how to deal with the emotion, but how to deal with the problems themselves. And so one of the things I was hoping to do is just, you know, contribute to and help start that conversation and help our readers acknowledge that it's happening and be able to talk about it too.
I think that's probably what struck such a chord with people, according to Paul, the publisher, that a lot of comments, because I think you touched on what's really real to all of us, that, you know, comes from our heart when we react or when we live our lives from there. And we identify with someone else who can articulate that in such a way that we understand. It's like one of those aha moments.
Mm-hmm.
What else are you working on right now?
Well, I am working on some editing projects for High Country News right now. I also this year have been producing a podcast for Mesa Verde National Park about archaeology and ancient and present-day communities in the Four Corners region, and hopefully going to get going on some new conservation stories pretty soon.
I was on the Long Mesa Fire there at Mesa Verde in my long BLM Forest Service career. That was the one of the really big fires that affected it before some other fires after that. But country's just really thick pinyon juniper and many, many ruins all over the place there. It's a special place.
Yep.
Especially the Ute Mountain Ute Tribal Park, which Mesa Verde was carved out of their tribal lands, and you can go to see their park there if you take a guide with you and pay them for that service. You'll see some of the ruins that are just as spectacular as Mesa Verde. Have you been to their park at all?
I haven't been to the tribal park, but it's definitely on my to-do list.
All right. Well, you know, it's been a pleasure to have you on the show. I really appreciate you coming and taking time out of your busy life to do this. Please, if you haven't already, pick up the issue, August 6th issue of High Country News. Kelly's story is, What Are We Doing Here? And I think once you read that story, you'll understand exactly what this whole thing is about when we talk about sense of place. Thanks again, Kelly.
All right. Thanks, Bill.
Thanks for listening today. You tuned in to For Land's Sake on KDNK's Public Affairs program. Next time, September 11th at 4:30, tune in again. And until then, remember, whatever you do to Mother Nature, do it for land's sake.